A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's personal. He's wrestling with catastrophic thinking. Specifically, he's in a dispute with a landlord who's treated his family terribly, and he finds himself jumping to the worst possible conclusion about how it'll end. Here's the thing. He can see he's doing it. He knows the thought is irrational. He can label it as a cognitive distortion. But that doesn't stop it from showing up, and it doesn't stop it from feeling true in the moment.
And that gap between knowing a thought is distorted and actually being free of it, that's the space where a lot of therapy lives. But Daniel's question goes somewhere more interesting. He's asking, what if someone couldn't even get that far? What if the thought didn't feel like an intruder you want to evict, but more like the only reasonable response to reality?
That's the asymmetry. Daniel's catastrophic thinking is what we'd call ego dystonic. It feels alien. It clashes with how he sees himself. He wants it gone. But for someone with a personality disorder, the same catastrophic narrative can feel egocentric. It doesn't show up as a problem to be solved. It shows up as a justified reading of the facts.
That changes everything about what treatment can even look like. If you can't step back from a thought and say, this might be distorted, then the entire collaborative frame of cognitive behavioral therapy, where therapist and patient examine the evidence together, that frame doesn't just get harder. The therapist isn't an ally helping you test a belief. The therapist becomes someone trying to take away the only thing that makes the world feel safe and predictable.
The question Daniel's really asking is, if classic CBT requires you to identify your own thought as distorted, what happens when someone's personality structure makes that identification impossible? And are there workarounds, or is that whole category of minds just walled off from this kind of help?
That's exactly the right question. And it's not just academic. It's the reason some therapies work brilliantly for anxiety disorders and fall flat for personality disorders. Same catastrophic content, completely different relationship to it.
Let's start with what that actually feels like. If you've never experienced egocentric thinking, and most people haven't, at least not in the way we're talking about, it's genuinely hard to imagine. Daniel's describing a thought that barges in and ruins his afternoon. He knows it's probably wrong. He can argue with it. He can name it. The distress is real, but the thought itself feels like an invader.
That invader quality is the hallmark of egodystonic experience. The thought conflicts with your values, your goals, your sense of who you are. You think, I'm not a person who assumes the worst, or this isn't how I want to operate. There's friction between the thought and the self. That friction is uncomfortable, but it's also the thing that lets you work on it. You can't fix what you can't see as broken.
Now flip it. An egocentric catastrophic thought doesn't feel like an invader. It feels like a loyal bodyguard. It's not, I'm jumping to conclusions about my landlord. It's, I'm being appropriately vigilant about a real threat. The thought and the self are fused. There's no second channel saying, hey, maybe we're overreacting here.
That fusion is the key concept. In acceptance and commitment therapy, they call it cognitive fusion. You're so wrapped up in the thought that you can't see it as a thought at all. It's just the way you experience the color of the sky or the temperature of the room. You don't question whether the sky is blue. You just see it. Egocentric catastrophic thinking works the same way. The threatening interpretation isn't an interpretation. It's just what's there.
Which is why I've described the egocentricity of narcissistic personality disorder as the cruelest design flaw imaginable. The thing that's causing the most damage is the one thing the person can't even examine. It's like having a broken bone that doesn't hurt. You keep walking on it, making it worse, because the alarm system that's supposed to tell you something's wrong never goes off.
That's a good clinical analogy, actually. Pain is information. Egodystonic distress is painful, but it's informative. It tells you something needs attention. Egocentric patterns are painless in that specific way, but they're quietly structural. They shape how you interpret everything without ever announcing themselves as a variable.
When Daniel says he can identify his catastrophic thinking as irrational, but still can't stop it, that's frustrating, but from a clinical standpoint, it's actually a sign that his metacognitive system is intact. He has what researchers call metacognitive awareness, the ability to observe his own thinking and judge it. That's the second channel I mentioned. It's not solving the problem, but it's the prerequisite for any solution to work.
That's where we need to get precise about what CBT actually requires. Beck's original cognitive therapy model, and this is Aaron Beck, who developed it in the 1960s, rests on something called collaborative empiricism. The therapist and patient become joint investigators. They look at the evidence for a thought together. Okay, you believe your landlord will evict you. What's the evidence? What's the counter-evidence? What's an alternative explanation? That process only works if the patient can entertain the possibility that the thought might be wrong.
If the thought feels like a protective truth, if questioning it feels like lowering your defenses against a hostile world, then the collaborative frame breaks. The therapist isn't a co-investigator anymore. They're an adversary. They're trying to talk you out of something that keeps you safe, and nobody willingly gives up their safety, even if that safety is built on a distorted foundation.
There's good data on this. Meta-analyses looking at CBT for borderline personality disorder find effect sizes around 0.3 to 0.5. That's small to moderate. Compare that to CBT for anxiety disorders, where effect sizes run 0.7 to 1.0, which is large. Same therapeutic approach, dramatically different results. And a big part of the explanation is that BPD patients often experience their catastrophic interpersonal interpretations. They're going to abandon me, they're manipulating me, as egocentric truths about others' malevolence, not as distortions to be corrected.
We're not just talking about different degrees of difficulty. We're talking about whether the basic mechanism of the therapy can even engage. It's like trying to use a screwdriver on a nail. The tool isn't bad. It's just designed for a different kind of problem.
That brings us to the case examples that make this concrete. Take Daniel's landlord situation. He can say, and I'm paraphrasing, "I know I'm jumping to conclusions. I know this isn't a foregone conclusion." The worry is irrational. That's ego dystonic. Now imagine someone with paranoid traits in the same situation. They'd say something like, "I'm not jumping to conclusions. I'm being realistic about the threat." This landlord has already shown they're hostile. Why would I assume anything other than the worst? Same catastrophic content, completely different relationship to it.
The paranoid traits version is internally consistent. It's not that the person is being stubborn or difficult. From inside that framework, assuming the worst is the only rational move. The thought isn't a distortion, it's pattern recognition. And if you try to do CBT-style evidence checking, you're not helping them see a distortion. You're challenging their pattern recognition. You're telling them their survival instincts are wrong.
That feels like gaslighting. I've seen this in clinical settings. A patient with narcissistic traits catastrophizing about being humiliated at work. To them, the catastrophic outcome isn't a cognitive distortion. It's the inevitable consequence of others' incompetence or jealousy. If you ask, what's the evidence that your colleagues want to humiliate you? You've just aligned yourself with the hostile forces. You don't understand the threat. You're part of the problem.
The therapist is in an impossible position. The very thing that makes CBT work, collaborative examination of the evidence, is experienced by the patient as an attack. You can't collaboratively examine something when one party thinks the examination itself is dangerous.
This isn't just about personality disorders in the clinical sense. The egocentric versus ego-dystonic distinction exists on a spectrum. Most people have some thoughts in each category. The political beliefs you never question, the family narratives you've inherited, the assumptions about how the world works that feel like common sense rather than interpretations. Those are egocentric. You don't examine them because you don't notice them as beliefs. They're just the water you swim in.
And that's why Daniel's experience, frustrating as it is, actually reflects a fairly sophisticated psychological capacity. He can hold a thought and simultaneously observe himself holding it. That's metacognition, thinking about thinking. It's not universal, and it's not binary. Some people have more of it, some less, and it varies by domain. You might be highly metacognitive about your work performance and completely fused with your beliefs about your romantic relationships.
The research on cognitive fusion backs this up. Measures of cognitive fusion. how tightly a person is wrapped up in their thoughts, predict treatment outcomes across multiple disorders, higher fusion, poorer response to standard CBT. Lower fusion, better response. It's not about the content of the thoughts, it's about the relationship between the thinker and the thought.
If we take Daniel's question seriously, does this mean classic CBT techniques are essentially impossible in people who are egocentric? The answer is nuanced. Not impossible, but the standard approach hits a wall. You can't start with, let's examine the evidence for this thought, when the person can't see the thought as a thought. You need to work on the metacognitive capacity first, or find a workaround that doesn't require it.
That's where the third wave therapies come in. ACT, schema therapy, mentalization-based treatment. They were developed specifically because clinicians kept running into this wall. Stephen Hayes developed ACT in the 1980s after realizing that arguing with thoughts was often counterproductive. Jeffrey Young developed schema therapy in the 90s for personality disorders that were resistant to standard CBT. Peter Fonagy and Anthony Bateman developed mentalization-based treatment around the same time, focusing on the capacity to understand mental states, your own and others.
Each of these approaches found a different way around the egocentric barrier, and the creativity of those workarounds is impressive. They don't try to make the person see the thought as distorted. They change the goal entirely.
Let's walk through them because they answer Daniel's question about whether there's any way to treat through workaround. ACT's approach is the most radical philosophical shift. Instead of asking, is this thought true? Which is the CBT question? ACT asks, is this thought helpful? And can I notice this thought without acting on it? That's cognitive diffusion. You don't need to label the thought as distorted. You just need to create a little space between the thought and your response to it.
The classic ACT diffusion exercise is exactly the kind of thing that would help with Daniel's landlord situation. Instead of my landlord will evict us, you practice saying I notice I'm having the thought that my landlord will evict us. That tiny linguistic shift, adding I notice I'm having the thought that, doesn't challenge the content. It doesn't require you to believe the thought is false. It just creates distance, and that distance is everything.
For someone with an egocentric catastrophic pattern, say, the person with paranoid traits, this can actually work where CBT can't, because you're not asking them to doubt their threat assessment, you're just asking them to notice it as a thought. I notice I'm having the thought that this person is trying to harm me. They can do that without abandoning their protective narrative. The thought can still feel true, but now there's a gap between the thought and the action.
Schema therapy takes a different angle. Instead of working on the surface-level catastrophic thoughts, it targets the underlying emotional schemas, the deep patterns like, people will abandon me, or I am fundamentally defective, or the world is dangerous. These schemas formed early, often in childhood, and they're egocentric in the deepest sense. They feel like identity, not belief.
Here's the clever part. Schema therapy validates the emotional truth of the schema while gently questioning the cognitive conclusion. So the therapist might say, it makes complete sense that you feel terrified of abandonment, given what happened to you. That feeling is real and valid. And, let's look at whether the evidence in this specific situation actually supports the conclusion that you're about to be abandoned right now. You're not arguing with the schema. You're honoring it while creating room for a different interpretation.
That validation step is crucial. One of the reasons egocentric patterns resist change is that any challenge feels like an invalidation of the person's entire life experience. You're telling me my read on this situation is wrong. That means you're telling me everything I learned about how to survive was wrong. Schema therapy sidesteps that by saying, no, your survival strategy made sense. It kept you safe. Let's just check whether it's the right tool for this particular moment.
Mentalization-based treatment goes even more foundational. It doesn't target thoughts or schemas directly. It targets the capacity for mentalization itself, the ability to understand that your own and others' behavior is driven by mental states that are subjective, fallible, and open to revision. For someone with low mentalization capacity, other people's actions are just, he left the room because he hates me, isn't an interpretation, it's a direct perception. MBT works on rebuilding that interpretive layer.
If someone can't mentalize, if they can't see their own thoughts as interpretations, rather than direct perceptions of reality, you don't start by challenging the interpretations. You start by building the muscle of wondering. I wonder what else might have been going on for him when he left the room. Not. Your interpretation is wrong. Just there might be other interpretations.
These approaches show real results. DBT, Dialectical Behavior Therapy, which Marsha Linehan developed for BPD, is probably the best-known example of a therapy that works with ego-syntonic patterns without requiring the patient to label them as distorted. DBT doesn't spend much time on cognitive restructuring. It focuses on distress tolerance, emotion regulation, interpersonal effectiveness. It says, you don't have to believe your thought is wrong. You just have to not act on it in ways that destroy your life.
The behavioral experiment is another workaround that bypasses the cognitive barrier entirely. You don't argue about whether the catastrophic outcome will happen. You design a small, low-stakes test. For Daniel's landlord situation, it might be, let's wait 48 hours before taking any action and write down what actually happens. Not what you fear will happen, what actually happens. The evidence accumulates over time, and it speaks for itself. The person doesn't need to believe the thought is distorted. They just need to agree to the experiment.
That's the paradox at the heart of all this. Ego-syntonic catastrophic thinking may actually be more resistant to change, but it's also less distressing to the person experiencing it. At least in the direct, this thought is torturing me, sense. The distress gets channeled into anger at others, or into a sense of being perpetually victimized, or into rigid control strategies. It's still suffering, but it's suffering that feels justified. Ego-dystonic catastrophic thinking causes more acute pain. Daniel's kind of pain. But it's more tractable precisely because the pain announces itself as a problem to be solved.
Daniel's distress is, counterintuitively, a kind of psychological privilege. It's the price of metacognitive access. He can suffer from his thoughts and simultaneously observe himself suffering from them. That dual awareness is what makes change possible, even when it's slow and frustrating.
For Daniel specifically, the goal isn't to stop catastrophizing entirely. That's probably not realistic, and it's not even necessary. The goal is to shorten the loop between the catastrophic thought and the metacognitive correction. Right now, the thought shows up, it feels true for a while, and then eventually he recognizes it as a distortion. With practice, that recognition can come faster. The thought still shows up, but it doesn't get to run the show for as long.
The observer shift is the practical tool here. When you notice the catastrophic thought, you say to yourself, and I mean literally say it in your head. I am having the thought that, followed by the catastrophic content, I am having the thought that my landlord will evict us and we'll be homeless. That framing doesn't argue with the thought. It doesn't require you to believe it's false. It just reminds you that it's a thought, an event in your mind, not a prophecy.
That's a daily practice, not a crisis intervention. You do it with small thoughts, not just the big ones. I am having the thought that this traffic will make me late. I am having the thought that my friend is annoyed with me. You build the muscle, so when the landlord-level catastrophes show up, the diffusion reflex is already there.
Which brings us to the broader point about understanding other people. If you're dealing with someone who seems unable to see their own catastrophic thinking as distorted, whether it's a personality disorder or just a rigid thinking style, arguing with them is almost always counterproductive. You can't reason someone out of a position they didn't reason themselves into. The thought feels like perception, not reasoning. Arguing with it feels like arguing with their eyes.
The better approach is to ask questions that open the door without pushing. What would it take for you to test that belief? What would need to happen for you to reconsider? If someone you trusted saw the situation differently, what would you want them to tell you? These questions respect the ego-syntonic experience. They don't challenge the belief directly, but they introduce the possibility of revision.
That's the skill, really. Learning to recognize which of your own thoughts are ego-syntonic and which are ego-dystonic. Most of us have both. The political conviction you've never questioned, the assumption about your own competence, the narrative about why your last relationship ended. Some of these are open to examination, and some feel like bedrock. The work is learning to tell the difference.
Daniel's question opens up something much bigger than a therapy technique comparison. It's about the architecture of self-awareness. Some minds can watch themselves think, some can't or can only do it in certain domains. And the entire enterprise of psychotherapy, at least the cognitive and metacognitive branches of it, depends on that capacity being at least partially online.
Which leaves us with a question that the field is still wrestling with. If third wave therapies like ACT and schema therapy and MBT can work around the ego-syntonic barrier, if they can help people change without requiring them to first see their thoughts as distorted, does that mean personality disorders are more treatable than we used to think? Or does it just mean we found better ways to work with the resistance?
The next frontier might push that even further. There are early trials looking at psychedelic-assisted therapy for personality disorders, specifically for borderline and narcissistic traits. The idea is that psychedelics temporarily disrupt the ego-syntonic fusion. They let people see their own patterns from the outside, sometimes for the first time. It's not a cure, but it might be a window, a chance to experience metacognitive distance that can then be practiced and strengthened.
That's a whole other episode. For now, I think the takeaway for Daniel, and for anyone who recognizes themselves in his description, is that the struggle itself is evidence of something working. The fact that you can see your catastrophic thinking as a problem is the thing that makes solving it possible. It doesn't make it easy, but it means the door isn't locked.
That door hinges on a distinction that's worth naming explicitly, because it's the difference between Daniel's experience and the experience he's curious about. Ego-syntonic versus ego-dystonic. The terms sound clinical, but what they describe is actually pretty intuitive once you feel the contrast.
Ego-dystonic thoughts feel like they don't belong to you. They clash with your self-concept. Daniel's catastrophic spiral about the landlord, he experiences it as an intrusion. This isn't how I want to think. This pattern doesn't serve me. It's harmful. There's friction. The thought and the self are in conflict.
That friction is uncomfortable, but it's also informative. It tells you something's off. Ego-syntonic thoughts don't create that friction. They feel like they fit. They feel like this is just who I am, or this is just how the world works. The thought and the self are aligned, so aligned that you might not even notice the thought as a thought. It's just reality, as far as you're concerned.
Daniel's catastrophic thinking is textbook ego-dystonic. He can step back and say, I'm jumping the gun. This isn't a foregone conclusion. The worry is irrational. He doesn't like that he thinks this way. It bothers him. He wants it gone.
Now imagine the same landlord dispute, same catastrophic content, but in someone whose personality structure makes that thinking ego-syntonic. They're not saying, I'm jumping to conclusions. They're saying, I'm being appropriately vigilant about a genuine threat. The thought doesn't feel like a cognitive distortion, it feels like pattern recognition. It feels like the only sane response to a hostile situation.
That's the core question Daniel's driving at. If CBT requires you to identify a thought as distorted before you can work on it, what happens when someone's entire personality structure prevents that identification? When the thought doesn't show up as a problem to be solved, but as a protective truth to be defended?
The therapeutic frame collapses. Not gradually, immediately. Because collaborative empiricism, which is the engine of classic CBT, depends on both parties agreeing that the thought is up for examination. If the patient experiences the thought as self-evident reality, then the therapist's invitation to check the evidence doesn't feel collaborative. It feels adversarial. It feels like the therapist is trying to take away something that keeps the patient safe.
That's not a failure of will or intelligence on the patient's part. It's not stubbornness. From inside that framework, questioning the catastrophic thought would be irrational. It would be like questioning whether fire burns. You don't examine the evidence for whether fire burns. You just know. Ego-syntonic catastrophic thinking operates with that same kind of certainty.
Which brings us to the mechanism underneath all of this. In ego-dystonic anxiety, Daniel's situation, the catastrophic thought triggers distress precisely because it conflicts with his values and goals. He doesn't want to be someone who assumes the worst. He doesn't want to live in that headspace. The thought hurts because it's alien.
The alarm goes off because there's a mismatch. The thought says disaster is coming, but his self-concept says, I'm not the kind of person who jumps to disaster. That clash is the distress, and it's also the signal that lets him work on it.
Now in ego-syntonic personality patterns, the catastrophic thought doesn't trigger that clash. It doesn't feel alien. It feels like the only reasonable response to a threatening world. The thought says, disaster is coming, and the self-concept says, of course it is. I've seen this before. I know how people operate. There's no mismatch, no signal that anything needs fixing.
The thought isn't a cognitive distortion to be corrected. It's a warning to be heeded, and that changes the entire emotional architecture. The distress is still there. the person is still suffering, but the distress gets attributed to the external threat, not to the thinking pattern. I'm not anxious because I'm catastrophizing. I'm anxious because the situation is catastrophic.
That's where the metacognitive gap becomes the whole story. Daniel has what you could call a second channel. He can observe his own thinking and judge it. He can say, I notice I'm spiraling about the landlord, and I know this spiral is probably not accurate. That's metacognition, thinking about thinking.
The egocentric thinker doesn't have that second channel, or at least not for this category of thought. The thought and the self are fused. There's no observer position. You can't watch yourself think if you don't know you're thinking. You just experience reality directly, and the catastrophic interpretation is part of that reality.
This is exactly what ACT researchers mean by cognitive fusion. It's a measure of how tightly a person is wrapped up in their thoughts. High fusion means you're inside the thought, looking out at the world through it. Low fusion means you can hold the thought at arm's length and look at it. Daniel has low fusion, not zero, but enough to work with. Someone with an egocentric personality disorder has high fusion. The thought isn't the lens, it's their eyes.
If the thought is your eyes, you can't examine it. You can't ask, is this lens distorting anything? Because you don't experience it as a lens. You just see through it. That's why classic CBT hits a wall here. Beck's whole model. Collaborative empiricism depends on both therapist and patient being able to look at the thought together. Let's examine the evidence for this belief. But if the belief doesn't feel like a belief, if it feels like a direct perception, then the therapist isn't inviting examination. The therapist is denying your reality.
I've seen this play out clinically. A patient with narcissistic traits catastrophizes about being humiliated at work. To them, the catastrophic outcome isn't a distortion. It's the inevitable consequence of others' incompetence or jealousy. If the therapist says, "Let's look at the evidence that your colleagues want to humiliate you," the patient doesn't hear a collaborative invitation. They hear someone aligning with the hostile forces. Someone who doesn't understand the threat. Someone who's part of the problem.
It feels like gaslighting. And from the patient's perspective, that's a completely rational reaction. If you perceive a threat and someone keeps asking you to prove it exists, they're not helping you. They're undermining you.
The data bears this out. Analyses on CBT for borderline personality disorder find effect sizes around 0.3 to 0.5. That's small to moderate. For anxiety disorders, effect sizes run 0.7 to 1.0, large. Same therapeutic modality, same basic techniques, dramatically different results. And a major factor is that BPD patients often experience their catastrophic interpersonal interpretations as egocentric truths. "They're going to abandon me" isn't a distortion to check, it's a pattern they've learned is reliable. Questioning it feels naive.
The therapist is in an impossible position. The tool that makes CBT work, collaborative examination, is experienced by the patient as an attack. You can't collaboratively examine something when one party thinks the examination itself is dangerous. The frame collapses before the work even begins.
It's worth being precise about what "can't see the thought as irrational" actually means. It's not that the person is unintelligent or lacks insight in general. It's that this specific category of thought is egocentric. They might be perfectly capable of metacognition in other domains. They might question their political beliefs or their taste in music. But when it comes to their core interpersonal schemas, the deep patterns about how relationships work and what people are like, those aren't up for review. They're the operating system, not an application.
That's the cruel design flaw I mentioned. The damage is structural, but the structure itself can't be perceived from the inside. You need a perspective outside your own personality to see it, and by definition, you don't have one.
If classic CBT hits a wall here, what actually works? The answer turns out to be surprisingly creative, and it might change how you think about therapy entirely. Because clinicians kept running into this exact wall, and they didn't just shrug and say, "Well, personality disorders are untreatable," they built new tools.
The first workaround is the most philosophically radical. ACT, acceptance and commitment. Therapy basically sidesteps the whole question of whether a thought is true or false. Instead of arguing with the thought, which is the CBT move, ACT changes your relationship to it. The question shifts from, "Is this thought accurate?" to, "Can I notice this thought without acting on it?"
That shift is enormous for egocentric patterns. You're not asking someone with paranoid traits to doubt their threat assessment. You're just asking them to notice it as a thought. The classic diffusion exercise. I notice I'm having the thought that my landlord will evict us, instead of my landlord will evict us. That tiny linguistic frame creates distance without requiring the thought to be false.
Daniel can use this too, by the way. It's not just for clinical populations. The diffusion move works whether your catastrophic thinking is ego-dystonic or ego-syntonic, because it doesn't depend on labeling the thought as distorted. It just depends on noticing that you're thinking it.
And for someone whose catastrophic thinking is fully ego-syntonic, this is the only entry point that doesn't trigger the adversarial collapse. You're not challenging the content. You're not saying your threat perception is wrong. You're saying, let's just notice this as a mental event. They can do that while still believing the threat is real.
Schema therapy takes a different angle. Jeffrey Young developed it in the 90s, specifically for patients who weren't responding to standard CBT, and his insight was that you need to work one level deeper, not on the surface catastrophic thought, but on the underlying emotional schema, the deep pattern like, people will abandon me, or I am fundamentally unlovable.
Here's the clever part. Schema therapy validates the emotional truth while gently questioning the cognitive conclusion. The therapist might say, it makes complete sense that you feel terrified of abandonment, given what happened to you as a child. That feeling is real and valid. And let's look at whether the evidence in this specific situation supports the conclusion that you're about to be abandoned right now.
It's not, but it's not. However, you're wrong. It's your feelings make sense, and let's check whether they match this moment. You're honoring the schema while creating room for a different interpretation.
Because one of the reasons ego-syntonic patterns resist change is that any challenge feels like an invalidation of the person's entire life experience. You're telling me my read on this situation is wrong? That means everything I learned about how to survive was wrong. Schema therapy sidesteps that by saying, no, your survival strategy made sense. It kept you safe. Let's just check whether it's the right tool for this particular moment.
Mentalization-based treatment, MBT, developed by Peter Fonagy and Anthony Bateman, goes even more foundational. It doesn't target thoughts or schemas directly. It targets the capacity for mentalization itself. The ability to understand that your own and others' behavior is driven by mental states that are subjective, fallible, and open to revision.
For someone with low mentalization capacity, other people's actions aren't interpretations, they're just facts. He left the room because he hates me isn't a guess, it's a direct perception. MBT works on rebuilding that interpretive layer. I wonder what else might have been going on for him when he left the room. Not your interpretation is wrong, just there might be other interpretations.
Then there's the behavioral experiment, which might be the most elegant workaround of all, because it bypasses cognition entirely. You don't argue about whether the catastrophic outcome will happen. You design a small, low-stakes test. For Daniel's landlord situation, it might be wait 48 hours before taking any action, write down what actually happens, not what you fear will happen. What actually happens?
The evidence accumulates over time and it speaks for itself. The person never has to agree that their thought was distorted. They just have to agree to the experiment. And after enough experiments, the catastrophic predictions start to look less like prophecy and more like a habit that's often wrong.
Which brings us to a paradox that's worth sitting with. Ego-syntonic catastrophic thinking may actually be more resistant to change, but it's also less distressing to the person experiencing it. At least in the direct, this thought is torturing me, sense. The distress gets channeled into anger at others, or into a sense of being perpetually victimized, or into rigid control strategies. It's still suffering, but it's suffering that feels justified.
Ego-dystonic catastrophic thinking. Daniel's kind causes more acute pain. The thought barges in and ruins your afternoon. You feel it as suffering, but that very pain is what makes it tractable. The distress announces itself as a problem to be solved.
Daniel's pain is, counterintuitively, a kind of psychological privilege. It's the price of metacognitive access. He can suffer from his thoughts and simultaneously observe himself suffering from them. That dual awareness is what makes change possible. Even when it's slow and frustrating.
For Daniel specifically, the goal isn't to stop catastrophizing entirely. That's probably not realistic, and it's not even necessary. The goal is to shorten the loop between the catastrophic thought and the metacognitive correction. Right now, the thought shows up, it feels true for a while, and then eventually he recognizes it as a distortion. With practice, that recognition can come faster. The thought still shows up, but it doesn't get to run the show for as long.
The fact that he can recognize his catastrophic thinking as irrational at all, that's actually a sign of psychological health. It means his self-concept is flexible enough to accommodate self-criticism. He can hold, I am having this thought, and this thought is probably wrong in his head at the same time. That's not a small thing.
That dual capacity to suffer and to observe yourself suffering, it's not evenly distributed. Some people have more of it, some less, and it varies by domain. You might be highly metacognitive about your work performance and completely fused with your beliefs about your romantic relationships. The skill is learning to recognize which thoughts are which in yourself.
That's the practical takeaway, I think. For Daniel, and for anyone who recognizes themselves in his description, the distress isn't a weakness. It's evidence that the metacognitive system is online. The alarm is working. The goal isn't to silence the alarm. It's to shorten the gap between when it goes off and when you recognize it's a false alarm.
The observer shift is the tool that does that. When you notice catastrophic thinking, you say to yourself, literally, in your head, I am having the thought that, followed by the catastrophic content, I am having the thought that my landlord will evict us and we'll be homeless. That framing doesn't argue with the thought. It doesn't require you to believe it's false. It just reminds you that it's a thought, an event in your mind, not a prophecy.
The key is making it a daily practice, not a crisis intervention. You do it with small thoughts, not just the big ones. I am having the thought that this traffic will make me late. I am having the thought that my friend is annoyed with me. You build the muscle, so when the landlord-level catastrophes show up, the diffusion reflex is already there. It's not about stopping the thought. It's about creating just enough space that the thought doesn't get to drive.
That space, that tiny linguistic gap, is exactly what egocentric thinkers can't access. Which means if you're dealing with someone who seems unable to see their own catastrophic thinking as distorted, arguing with them is almost always counterproductive. You can't reason someone out of a position they didn't reason themselves into. The thought feels like perception, not reasoning. Arguing with it feels like arguing with their eyes.
The better approach is to ask questions that open a door without pushing. What would it take for you to test that belief? What would need to happen for you to reconsider? If someone you trusted saw the situation differently, what would you want them to tell you? These questions respect the egocentric experience. They don't challenge the belief directly, but they introduce the possibility of revision. You're not saying you're wrong. You're saying, what would it look like if you were...
That's a skill worth developing regardless of which side of the spectrum you're on. Because the egocentric versus egodystonic distinction isn't binary, it's not two buckets. Most of us have some thoughts in each category. The political conviction you've never questioned, the assumption about your own competence, the narrative about why your last relationship ended. Some of these are open to examination, and some feel like bedrock. The work is learning to tell the difference.
Where does that leave us on the bigger question? If ACT and schema therapy and MBT can all work around the egocentric barrier, if they can help people change without requiring them to first see their thoughts as distorted, does that mean personality disorders are more treatable than we used to think? Or do we just get better at working with the resistance?
I think it's both, honestly. The disorders themselves haven't changed. What changed is we stopped trying to reason with the part of the mind that doesn't reason. These newer approaches don't ask the egocentric structure to dismantle itself. They work around it, or underneath it, or they build new structures alongside it. That's not the same as curing a personality disorder in the way we cure an infection, but it's genuine change.
The next frontier might push that even further. There are early trials looking at psychedelic-assisted therapy for borderline and narcissistic traits. The hypothesis is that psychedelics temporarily disrupt egocentric fusion. They let people see their own patterns from the outside, sometimes for the first time. It's not a cure, but it might be a window. A chance to experience metacognitive distance that can then be practiced and strengthened once the substance wears off.
The early data is tentative but intriguing. If diffusion is the lock, psychedelics might be a key that fits, not permanently, but long enough to show someone what the door looks like.
Which is a whole other episode. For now, Daniel, you asked what it feels like on the other side of this divide, and whether the therapies that help you can help someone who can't even see the divide exists. The answer is, different therapies, same goal. Not eliminating catastrophic thoughts, but changing your relationship to them. And the fact that you can ask the question at all. That you can wonder what someone else's inner world is like. That's the very capacity that makes your own inner world workable.
Send us your weird prompts. The ones that keep you up at night. The ones that make you wonder how other minds work. We'll dig into them.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com.
If you've got a prompt rattling around in your head, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We read everyone.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.